Hi, I'm Ryan Levy. Welcome to Cyberism's Malicious Life. This week, we have yet another B-side episode. B-sides are interview-based episodes where we tackle topics and stories less suited for our regular, more narrative episodes. In this B-side, we're discussing Cuckoo Spear, an espionage campaign targeting Japanese companies by a Chinese nation-state threat actor known as APT-10. As you'll soon hear, APT-10 has been active since at least 2006, and in recent years has been using a backdoor malware named LoadInfo. A few months ago, researchers from CyberReason were able to link APT-10 to a new malware family called Noopdoor. This new malware incorporates highly sophisticated persistence mechanisms, allowing APT-10 to evade detection and remain inside enterprise networks for 2 or even 3 years. Our guests in this episode are the two researchers from CyberReason's incident response team who investigated the case, Jin Ito and Luigi Castell. I'll let them introduce themselves. I tend to treat these B-side episodes as great learning opportunities. So during the interview, we'll take short breaks to introduce and explain various technical terms and ideas. Enjoy the episode. So hello to Luigi and hello to Jin. Please introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Jin Ito. I am an incident response engineer at CyberReason. I have been with the company for about 1 year, and before that, I also did, you know, incident response and malware analysis for an organization, a Japanese company.
Hi, Ran. I'm Loic. I'm based in France, doing incident response for CyberReason since almost 3 years now. And I've got a bit of a past with both the blue team side doing IR and doing security operation center work, as well as doing pen testing, red teaming, this kind of thing. So I love that research that we are going to talk about today.
Thank you for joining me on the podcast. I very much appreciate it. We are a truly international conversation today. I'm from Israel, Luigi is from France, and Jin is in Japan. So our story today will revolve around the research that you recently did called Cuckoo Spear. And I think it begins long before CyberReason itself got involved in the investigation with a malware that is now known as LoadInfo. So tell me about LoadInfo and what other researchers prior to your involvement in the investigation discovered about it.
Sure. So LoadInfo, in short, is a sophisticated backdoor. When we think of backdoors, we just think of you can run arbitrary commands and execute any sort of, you know, tasks that you want on the remote computer. It has that capability, and it also has capabilities to upload and download files and run additional code as necessary. It's just basically whatever you need to do on the computer, that's the program to do it. And as far as I know, I think it's been used by APT-10 since 2019, and there's a lot of research going into this, and then we can see the various versions that it has been evolving over the past 5 years or so, I would say. And then every iteration, it just keeps improving, creating new encryptions and changing the sizes, perhaps different loading mechanisms, and et cetera, et cetera. And I guess how it relates to the malware that we are presenting today, it's that they don't necessarily work together, but I would say that this Noopdoor malware that we have right now that we analyzed is a more modified and evolved version of that LoadInfo, I would say, which we will get into detail later.
Yeah, we'll talk in more depth about APT-10 that you mentioned and about Noopdoor that you mentioned as well. What kind of organizations were hit with LoadInfo in the past? Do they have like some sort of a
common characteristic?
So I think it goes in hand with the targets of APT-10's targets, which are mostly, I mean, obviously, I can't speak for them, but they are targeting a lot of critical infrastructure companies, a lot of sort of media companies that talk about the new Chinese activities, whether it's weapons or any just sort of geopolitical topics, and also IT companies that create IT systems for, you know, the government essentially in that country I guess those are the prime targets that we keep hearing about from these actors.
So how did Cyber Reason get involved in the investigation?
We had a new customer and starting to have detection using our solution. And it was very quickly known that this was a complicated threat, was not something common, something that that has been seen. And it was involved data theft, very espionage, techniques, and so the customer decided to dive deeper in this and engaged us as incident responders. So we started to investigate the machine where odd behaviors happened, extract some techniques, and we decided to pivot from those techniques to the rest of our customers' base, and we did find two other victims involved. Later, we had another, but which was not a customer, which made four in total that we worked on as incident response, involving both tools used by the same threat actor.
So the malware was present in these organizations' network for a pretty long time before it was discovered. How was that persistence maintained on the networks? What were the techniques LoadInfo was using?
In his response that you'll hear in a minute, Jin will mention a few Windows mechanisms which Noopdoor uses in order to maintain persistence in the infected networks. So for those listeners who aren't familiar with Windows development, let's quickly break down a few of these key mechanisms. Task Scheduler is a Windows component that launches programs or scripts at predefined times or following a specific event, also known as a trigger. The scheduler can be used to perform routine tasks, such as sending an email message, displaying a message box, or, in our case, running the malware. MS Build, or the Microsoft Build Engine, is a component which allows developers to build applications. That is, convert source code files into executable software. The developer provides an XML-based configuration file that describes the items to be built and various tasks that are part of the build process, such as create directories, copy files, and the like. And finally, WMI, or Windows Management Instrumentation. This is a platform that sysadmins can use in order to remote control Windows-based machines, usually in an enterprise network environment. For example, running an administrative script in response to a certain event. Armed with these concepts, let's return to our interview.
The main persistence mechanisms were scheduled tasks, running specific commands with scheduled tasks. They had, they were using MS Build that I think Microsoft, it's a part of the Microsoft .NET component to build and compile and execute a C# code. There was a scheduled task to compile and run the code. So they had actual source code of the injector on the systems, but of course it's obfuscated. So that was one. The other was the a WMI event consumer saying that this specific event would occur, this execution would occur when a specific event occurs. And the other one was a DLL. So those two that I just talked about, they were written in C#, and there was a source code. But the next one, there was a service DLL. obviously it's in a DLL format, highly obfuscated. It was, you know, created as a service, depending on, it just loads itself as a service. It loads shell code from the registry that is encrypted. So it decrypts shellcode from the registry based on things like machine IDs, some hashes they get from, you know, each and every system that were unique to each and every system. So it's not like you can create, you know, a script that can just decrypt all of the nuke door payloads because it was unique to each system. So you had to enter in like we made a script, but you had to also enter in like machine specific information to eventually decrypt it and be able to extract the nuke door and then figure out what it was doing. So, yes.
Just to add on this, before the persistence happened on all the machines we investigated, we also noticed the threat actors moving laterally from a previously compromised machine, and that's basically what they did all the time. They just compromised a set of machine, and then from this set of machine they moved to other machines, dropped a file, loaded the malware, so Noob Door, and erased that file, because after they loaded that Noob Door into the registry, like Gene said, they basically got a fully operational backdoor, not leaving any file on the system. So there is still disk evidence because it's in the registry, but it's not a file. And yeah, using these techniques, they used different ones each time, depending on the later tool they wanted to run. They were able to control those machines.
How were the attackers able to sneak in that malware into the organization itself? What was the method of infiltration, you might say?
So initially, load info was known to be pushed by threat actors through an initial access called spear phishing, which is the use of various trickery or scams to manipulate the victim into executing something malicious on their machine. And then from that machine, the threat actors move to the rest of the infrastructure and do the rest of the post-infiltration techniques. They used to start, for instance, COVID-19 pretext to get into a network. They use this kind of pretext, and then they also used specific documents targeted to the sector they were targeting and to the countries as well. In the case of the incidents we investigated, we had one case also involving spear phishing, and I'm saying that with quote, because the incidents happened 2 years, even more than 2 years before we started the incident response. So in that kind of cases, the more we wait between an event and the time we investigate, of course, that reduces a lot the probabilities that our conclusion are right. But we were able to say with 75% probability that spear phishing was involved in that case. But on the other case, and it was also mentioned by other vendors researching the same threat actor, the victims had Array AG VPN, which is a very popular VPN solution used in firewall VPN solution used in Japan, and another had Fortinet firewall being breached to do the attack. So that either means the threat actor changed their initial access technique because it was not working anymore, or because they had this opportunity of using the firewall, which was more convenient as an attacker than spear phishing, or it was a different threat actors all over, different operators inside the same team.
Now, there's a question that I'm curious about for both of you, I'm guessing. once you realize that you're investigating a nation state threat actor, I'm guessing that it's kind of rare to have investigations that actually track these kinds of actors. How exciting was it for you to personally to investigate such a case, to actually go head to head with a nation state threat actor?
Obviously, it was very exciting for me because I have worked on nation state IR cases before, but none to this level, I would say, where they had, I guess we'll talk a bit later, but the tools that they were using are very sophisticated in that, I'm getting a bit technical, but they use shellcode for their entire the C2 framework.
Jin mentioned shellcode. So here's another learning opportunity. What is shellcode? Shellcode is code that runs in a command line environment, such as command.exe on Windows. In the context of malware, it refers to a malware payload, code that can be executed once it is injected into a running application. Once a malware is able to exploit a vulnerability, for example, a buffer overflow, to inject the shellcode into memory and trick the program to run it, the shellcode runs with all the privileges of the exploited application. The downside is that writing shellcode is quite challenging. It requires in-depth understanding of low-level programming languages like C, C++, or even assembly, since each operating system has its own shellcode. And while we're at it, C2 is short for Command and Control Infrastructure, a software used by the attackers to communicate with compromised machines inside the network.
Creating shellcode itself is, you have to have some specific coding methodologies to create that. It's not like you can just link the libraries and use regular Windows things like creating files and et cetera, So I can see from the sophistication is that I need to understand everything about this attack that is going on, because aside from the part of IR, because this is just such a great opportunity to be able to take a look at this, and it's ongoing, which is also a great thing that was going on as well. Because in terms of IR, you don't need to do the full analysis, I would say, of the tools and the techniques that they're doing, as long as you are able to stop the attack, contain it, and then, get them out of the network, and then, patch whatever you need to do so they don't come back again. So you don't really need to look at, I guess, some of the specific details of the malware. But it's just something so interesting that, I guess, that pushed me and Loic to document a lot more than what was necessary to do IR. And so I guess that's why we're here today. And I think one interesting thing that about this attack is that I told you I joined Cyber Reason a year ago. And then this attack happened, I think, a few months after I joined. But the interesting thing is that I was analyzing a very similar tool using probably the same DGA, I think a year ago in my previous organization. So I saw it in action and in actual, a Japanese company that I was working for. And then I'm actually looking at it again from a vendor perspective, and I can see everything that is all the havoc that it's causing. And it's just, it's very interesting. It's very fun.
If I may add something as well, the containment strategy we use is also going to be very different from, I would say, the most common IRs, because we know this is the very advanced threat actors. We know they are disseminated all over the network. They might have multiple other types of backdoor that we didn't identify. So in that kind of scenarios, we take a lot of attention studying before doing any action. We know these kind of threat actors, they monitor the infrastructure, they monitor their victims' infrastructure, so they know what's happening inside the network. So we cannot start to, for instance, block the C2's IPs stop a specific hash from running. If we start to do that, the threat actors are going to change strategy very quickly, and basically they are going to play whack-a-mole with us and our victims. So they're going to change strategy, then we are going to identify that new strategy, block that, and that's going to happen for a very long time. So in that kind of case, you want to take a lot of caution and containment and recovery strategy specific to this kind of threat actors.
Yeah, it sounds almost as if you're playing a game of chess against the attackers, kind of a battle of wits of sort. So maybe just to kind of set the baseline for our listeners, can you please describe like the flow of a typical attack, how it kind of moves forward from the initial infiltration?
The first thing that you do when you go into an organization is make sure you have access again. So I think this is one of the very first things that you do. They install the persistent mechanism either through MS Build or the WMI or the service. And then that's when they have access to that machine, so they can come back whenever. And then they start doing the sort of reconnaissance, the getting the usernames, the passwords, and et cetera, going to the domain controller and et cetera. And we also saw a sort of internal C2 also within these engagements, which meant that it was a modification of the Nupedor malware, but it was modified so it's just ran as a server instead. This one doesn't directly communicate to the internet, to the outside. It just it's all internal, and we believe it was used as a sort of relay point between other pivot points within the victim's network, so they can aggregate information or be able to ease their operations much more. So I guess that's how they scattered throughout the entire network, and they were able to compromise, I would say, hundreds of devices in that sense.
So there's both an internal C2 and an external C2 as well?
Yes. I would say the external C2 is just, it's on the attacker side. That's where the Nupedor connects to based on the domain generation algorithms that it uses. And then the internal C2 is, as you said, it's just run on the victim's server or whatever, and we see communications going to that server to aggregate information. Again, it's the same backdoor methods. It can run code, mm-hmm. It can load files and drop files, and maybe that's where they were aggregating all the user info and et cetera, but we didn't exactly see them being aggregated there. It's just based on the telemetry and the capabilities of that server code. Is that's what we think it was used for.
That internal C2 also give them the capability of controlling machines that are not connected to the internet, so that are constrained to in a constrained network, and that gives also some hints of the type of victims they are targeting, that they have some maturity in cybersecurity to have this kind of network.
Meaning like maybe an internal air gap that kind of prevents internal systems to access the internet, right?
Absolutely. So not completely air gap, because they still need a connection to the network that hosts the internal C2. But definitely.
Yeah. What other kinds of tools were used in the attacks?
That's the interesting bit as well in all these incidents, is that we didn't notice any third-party hacking tool that we usually notice in other incidents, such as, on the top of my head, ngrok for creating tunnels, or Mimikatz for credential theft. That wouldn't be too serious for nation state actors to use Mimikatz like that, but just as an example. Their backdoor, as Jean mentioned, which was very big in size and had a lot of capabilities, allowed them to do most of those actions. The credential gathering, the reconnaissance, everything around exfiltration as well, the tunneling capabilities, everything could be done through that backdoor. The only thing that we noticed was the use of embedded Windows utility. We often call them lolbins, living off the lens tools. That's what we noticed the most. We did notice some credential theft, so LSAS process dumping to get clear text credentials or this kind of attack, but it was always using tools that already existed on the machine to do that.
Okay, and we mentioned before the use of a domain generation algorithm, DGA. So maybe let's dig a little deeper into that technique. What is domain generation algorithm and how was it used?
Usually when computers connect to the internet, they connect based on a domain which resolves to an IP address, and then you're connecting to that IP address. But if the domain keeps changing and the IP can change as well, it's just a method that attackers use so they can, you know, change their infrastructure, make it harder to block them. Because if it keeps on constantly changing, you're not going to know what domain to block. And especially in this case, where it was used was that there were a couple different domains that were being used. The top level domain, meaning like, let's say www.google.com, that would be a lot of domains that people use. But instead of Google, it would just be www.therandomalgorithmgenerated.com. Which essentially becomes like, how do you block that on the firewall unless you block everything www.com or unless you know the domain itself. But there were also other ones where it was like, you know, google.hosting.com, where if you just block the DGA before the hosting, you can block those. But there were some challenges and a lot of challenges, I would say, in identifying the domains to block. That's why we created scripts. We reverse engineered the domain generation algorithms. Not going to get into too much detail, but it just gets, you know, computer specific information, makes some hashes, and dynamically generates some random letters. But it's essentially not random. You can reverse engineer it and create scripts to understand, create, and to know which domains are going to be generated in the future. Because we see it change in 180 days, 365 days, maybe 90 days. It depends on which machine and which type of, I guess, which iteration of Nukedoor that it was using. And so we created scripts so the victims can just block any domains that were going to be generated in for the foreseeable future.
Okay, so let's turn our attention to the threat actor that was involved in that case. We already mentioned its name, APT-10. So keeping in mind how difficult it is to actually attribute an attack, what do we know about APT-10?
From analyzing this attack, it is apparent that they have a lot of resources at their disposal. And one interesting side topic is that I think a lot of attacks that we saw ended at 5 or 6 p.m. in Chinese local time, and then it started at 9, so they were working between those working hours. And but that's off topic, I would say. But yes, it's apparent that they have a lot of resources working on the operations of this and the development of their tools, because as I said, Nukedoor, we found a lot of Nukedoors. I think it was over 20 or 30, maybe 40 samples of Nukedoor itself, the shellcode, but none of them were the same exactly. There was always some sort of different hard-coded strings that were different that makes the DGA unique a little bit. And so I think in that sense, they must have had some sort of automatic tool to generate different iterations of this malware. And so just creating that and also creating the shellcode and the entire operations of it, how they were so surreptitious in their operations, it's you can tell a lot of work has gone into this. And I think that's one of the most interesting things we can conjecture about this attack.
Just one thing. In terms of targeting, Cuckoo Spear campaign has been targeting Japan APT10 has had more global scope. So they've been known to target also UK organization, likely the US as well. So APT9 is more a global organization, while Cuckoospear is very focused on using the tools we are documenting, and also targeting Japan. That's the
Thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure.
Very nice to be with the on this podcast. Thank you so much.
So cool. Thanks.
Thank you very much. CK Music.